For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Yeah. Let us pick up in our story. So what we got up to last week is we basically got up to the conversation between Rivka and Yaakov. So to summarize where we're holding, in your blue stone Chumash, we're going to be holding on page 136. We'll start there, and then we'll flip to our photocopied pages of the commentaries in a moment. Where we got up to last week is the conversation. Let's start from the beginning. Yitzchak, the father, asks his son Esav to go to the field, hunt him game, bring him fresh food as he so enjoys, and then he will be able to bless him before he dies. Esav leaves, exits stage left. Rivka has overheard this whole thing, calls in her younger son Yaakov, and this is the last part of the story that we had discussed, and says to him, with slight variations of the way that Yitzchak had spoken to the older son Esav, she says to her younger son Yaakov, you need to go out to the back, fetch me my two goats, I will prepare them as your father loves, you will go in instead and receive these blessings. And he says, but I'm going to get caught. My brother is a hairy man, and I am one of smooth skin. And she says, do not be afraid of receiving curses instead of blessings upon me. Will be your cursings, just do as I say. Shema b'koli. Listen to my voice in the same way that her mother-in-law, Sarah, had said to Abraham, listen to my voice. Kick out Yishmael, he is not part of this family. Only Yitzchak. Now Yitzchak's wife does the same thing to him and says, or to her son, Shema b'koli, listen to my voice. This is what needs to be done as far as the perpetuation of the Jewish people and the Abrahamic destiny. So that's where we last left off. We'll pick up with that, in which Yaakov is now going to get dressed up, and then we'll work through again a little bit of the drama as he enters in through the comments of Rashi and Ramban. And then I don't know if we'll get through the whole thing today in both of them, but shortly thereafter we'll then go through this whole story with Rav Hirsch. We'll just have to deal with a long Pesach break in between, and you'll be sitting on the edges of your seats the entire Yontif. Okay. If you want to read the story straight through, it's on page 136, 137, as I mentioned. I guess it's probably even better if you'll flip to your Rashi sheets, your white long sheets, and we will pick up on the page number got cut off. It's the fourth page, not including the cover page, it's the third page in, beginning verse 14, and 15 on the top of the page on the right hand side. Okay, so let's just start with the verses. We'll start on the verse 14 on the very top of the page. Vayelech, so he went. Vayikach vayoveli imo, he fetched and he brought to his mother. Vatas imo matamim kaasher ahiv aviv, and his mother made the delicacies as his father loved them. On the right hand side of the page, on the very top, hope everyone's got where I am. So we now, okay, this is where we left last week. Yaakov goes to the backyard, picks up the two goats. Rashi, if you remember, quoted from the sages, why were there two goats? How much meat can his father Yitzchak eat? So Rashi commented it was Pesach. One of them was the Passover sacrifice that was to be brought. And we find, I will just mention this since it's really appropriate for the time of year that we're holding in, Pesach before we know it, next week, Monday night. So,
surprise.
Yeah, surprise. If you weren't ready, guess what? I'm sorry to surprise you if you weren't prepared for that. So, we find numerous references, I think we touched this a little last week as well, numerous references to Pesach throughout the Chumash. Even though the Pesach story hasn't happened throughout the book of Bereishis, the idea that the sages say that the early fathers, Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, kept the Torah, observed its laws, and Pesach, whether or not in its observance or through the themes of Pesach, are found sprinkled throughout the story. The birth of Yitzchak took place on Pesach. The angels coming to tell Avraham that he was going to have a son took place on Pesach, as we referenced last week. When Avraham runs into the tent, he says to Sarah, quick, make matzos for our guests. You find that kind of, I believe, the story of Lot, which happens right afterwards, when the angels leave Avram, they go to Lot. Also, there's references to Pesach over there as well. And we have, of course, over here now again, the Pesach story pops up where the blessings are involved. And the two goats, the sages say, oh yeah, one of the goats was for the Paschal sacrifice, which of course, even though the story hadn't taken place, the idea, the concepts in the world existed, that's for another time, that whole concept. Okay, but in any case, let's just get back into verse 15. Vatikach Rivka es bigdei Esav b'no hagadol hachamudot. Rivka then took her older son Esav's, now we're going to translate it as Rashi does here, clean garments. The Torah's words are bigdei chamudos. Now chamudos is a tricky word, which we're going to see in Rashi, has more than just one word of interpretation. But she clearly took some type of special clothing that Esav had left in her home, and she dresses, she clothes her younger son Yaakov in them. And again, we find here, Rashi's not going to address this, but in verse 15, again, you see older son Esav, younger son Yaakov, over and over and over again in the story. We always have these defining descriptions of the boys, the older, the younger, his son, daughter, always that kind of phrase. So she has these clothing, and not only does Yaakov go in which he's going to, as we see, he's got to worry about his smooth skin versus his hairy body. He wears Esav's clothing. Special clothing. Big de chamudo. Says Rashi, what are these clothing and where do they fit in over here? Rashi in verse 15 says, hachamudos. These means the clean ones. As the Targum Unculus translates it as either pure or clean. So the most simple meaning is clean, and that's why in the Art Scroll English translation, they translate it as clean. It's not the most simple meaning of the word chamud. If you have any Israeli friends, and an Israeli friend is holding a little baby, they will say, oh, eze chamud, o eze chamuda, how sweet, how delicious, how cute. It's the language of how special to be chamud or chamuda. So Rashi quotes from the sages. In context, you can translate it to mean pure or clean. Alternatively, chamudos is the coveted one. There might be anyone was at, you were there last night, the 10th of the 10 commandments is called Lo Sachmod, from the same word, Sachmod, the 10th of the 10 commandments, anybody knows, what is it?
Do not covet.
Excellent, do not covet. The word Lachmod is the same, it's desirable, it's cute, and in that verb form is, do not desire it, do not covet that which your friend has. So we have here the reference of the word of chamudos, desirous or coveted, that Esav's clothing were defined as coveted. Rabbi Neuger gave a class last night. Rabbi Neuger gave a class in which he referenced this tenth of the Ten Commandments. Do not covet. And there's a major question that everybody asks on it. The Torah can obligate us not to do certain things. How can it command us not to want certain things? I want it.
But isn't there a distinction?
Between what?
Well, wanting it and covet, as I would understand it, means that you want it and you don't want your neighbor to have it.
No, it's just a matter of you don't want what he has. You can't want and desire what it is that he has. So the question is asked, how does the Torah command us in almost like an emotion and a feeling and not to desire, I want something? So the Ibn Ezra is one of the medieval commentators, explains it with a parable. And he says, what it means to say is a person really only desires things which he thinks is relevant to him. That's where you picture it in your mind as being possible to have and you want it. Something which is beyond your realm, very rarely desire something that doesn't enter into your world as being a possibility. So he tells a parable of the king passing through a small little town on his way from his palace to some big city. So they drive through the roads and they pass through all these small little towns, and as they pass through the small little towns, all of the townsfolk, they never get to see the king, and now the king is driving right through their town, so they all crowd around to watch the royal procession going through their little town. And the king is sitting there with his queen, and in the back of the carriage is the beautiful princess. As the carriage rolls by, and the small common folk farmer, illiterate and uneducated, stands to wave at his king, and he sees the beautiful princess in the back, says the Ibn Ezra, that farmer, that peasant farmer, doesn't desire to marry the princess. It doesn't enter into his head, wow, maybe I'll be able to win her over and marry her. She's so beyond his world. He doesn't know how to read or write. He's a small, ignorant, poor farmer living in the small outskirts of the countryside. He doesn't see her and say, she wouldn't even look to him. It's not something, he doesn't desire. Ibn Ezra says, if a Jew looks at what his friend has with that same set of eyes of, it's not relevant to me, I can't, it's not even something I think about, the Torah can demand of us to say, it's not for me. It's so beyond my world that I wouldn't even think of wanting it. That's what the Ibn Ezra writes. So the Ba'alei Musar, the school of thought that arose in the late 1700s and early 1800s of personal work, perfection, improvement, that worked on each individual Jew, the idea of study, so they developed on that idea, they shifted it a little bit. They wanted man to realize one of the schools of thought, specifically Nevardok, believed in teaching man the greatness of man, that man can become something special, should always view himself in that way, as something that has the ability to achieve greatness. And when they would say over that Dvar Torah from the Ibn Ezra, they would say it, but really it's a little bit switched. It's not that the Jew demands of us to be the peasant farmer looking at a princess and say to ourselves, it's not for me. The Torah demands of us to view ourselves as the princess looking down at the peasant farmer and saying, that's not for me. It's not for me. I'm beyond that. I'm above that. And a Jew walks around in life saying, I should steal. I should cheat. Be dishonest. I don't desire that. That's so below me. That's not for somebody like me with my stature. And that's the way they would shift as they were trying to train their students to look at themselves with the potential of greatness, of being endowed with a Tzelem Elokim, the image of God, the holy, pure neshama. These things up, that doesn't interest me. I'm so above those types of things. In any case, all that is a sidebar from the word lo sachmod. Sachmod means to desire or to covet. So that the word the Torah uses to describe Esau's clothing is all the Torah meant. And this is classic layering in the sages. We've seen many examples of this. If all the Torah meant was that they were clean, that she had a clean set of clothes in her closet, why would they have to be clean? Because again, remember, Esav is also going to change. When you go out to hunt, you don't wear your finest, you wear your hunting clothes. You get dirty, you got to slaughter, it's a messy thing, it's smelly. And then once the meal is prepared, after you're finished cooking, then you change, and he's going to come into his father and present him to dine a beautiful meal, but he's going to get dressed up. So she needed clean clothes to put Yaakov in when he was going to come in, that he should look fresh. If all the Torah wanted to tell us was that she had a clean set of Esav's clothing in the closet, it wouldn't have used the word chamudos, because chamudos has so many other meanings. It means to desire, it means to covet, it means sweet, it means... There's more stuff there. It would have said a different word for clean that only means clean, like naki or nikiot. So the fact this is a layering that the sages pull aside on the simple meaning of the text, what does the Torah want to tell us? She had a clean set of clothing from Esav in her closet that she puts on Yaakov. But when the Torah tells us that, it uses a word that has so many other meanings. So rich. It's not the first meaning of the word chamud is not clean. But if that's what it wanted, why would it choose that word? So the sages say, because there's deeper layers of meaning embedded into the text, and that is Dover Acher, alternatively, Chamudos is understood as the coveted ones, because he coveted them and took them from Nimrod. Now, if you recall, we're going to trace these clothing. The sages, Rashi here is giving us an abbreviated version. You see in the notes on the bottom, the extended version. Rashi quotes the abbreviated version of the Medrash. When Adam and Eve are expelled from Gan Eden for the first time, the Torah says, before God kicked them out, he did one thing to them. Clothed them. He made them clothing. So it's the first set of garments. The first set was man-made. Adam and Eve, realizing their nakedness and their embarrassment, they took leaves and they fashioned some type of apron out of their leaves to cover their nakedness. And then the Torah says, when God sent them out, he actually made them clothing. And that becomes the first instance in which we find the concept of clothing, not just to cover one's nakedness, because they had that already. It was something more or different, and it was God-made. That, like, made in China, it was God-made clothing. That set of clothing, you can imagine, was something special. It was special. And the sages trace that set of clothing from Adam and Eve down to Nimrod. Nimrod, who was the first warrior who conquered and set up, who was the force behind the Tower of Babel, if you remember, the tower that they was built to wage war against God. And then Esav came and stole or was victorious over Nimrod and took the clothing from him. And he was keeping it as a safekeep in his mother's house. And that's the clothing that Rivka takes and gives to her son, Yaakov. Now, for our purposes, we're going to leave it at this. But one of the things, and I hope we'll have a chance to get back to this, and you'll have to remind me, what's the significance that at this juncture in history, in other words, when the sages do these things, what they're doing is they're tracing a theme, a concept that begun with Adam and Eve being clothed as they're expelled from Gan Eden into the world at large, and God provides them with the clothing to do so. And then somehow that clothing and the meaning embedded within them traces itself down to Nimrod, the first warrior, down to Esav, and then it's going to be taken by Yaakov, and the sages aren't done, because they're then going to trace that Yaakov is going to hand it off to Yosef. He makes him a ketones pasim, this fine linen tunic that he's going to give to his son, Yosef. Yosef turns around and gives clothing when he reveals himself at the end of the book to his brothers. He gives all of his brothers a change of clothing. And to his brother, Binyamin, he gives 5 sets of clothing. A very odd verse, considering that how much had happened because Yosef had been favored with a set of garments in the beginning of the story. But now at the end of the story, he gives all of his brothers clothing, just odd in itself. What's the significance of that? And to his brother, Binyamin, his only full brother, he gives 5 sets of clothing. And then the sages trace that down to the reason why his brother Binyamin needed 5 sets of clothing is because his descendant Mordechai was going to leave the palace of Achashverosh adorned with 5 royal garments, as the Megillah tells us at the end of the story of Purim. So that when you trace the sages and the clothing, it starts with God made to Adam and to Eve, taken by Nimrod, taken by Esav. Here in our story, taken by Esav's mother, Rivka, and handed to Yaakov. There's like this change in the line from Nimrod, Esav, and all of a sudden it gets brought back to Yaakov, because he's about to sneak in and steal a bracha. He's given those garments. Yaakov himself, the holder of this garment, is going to make a special garment for his son Yosef, who's going to give garments to all of his brothers, 5 garments to his full brother Binyamin, representative of the 5 garments of royalty that Mordechai will eventually walk out of the palace with. What's the meaning behind all of that? So, not for now.
You have us all worked out.
I just wanted to see if you're interested in finding out the answer. In any case, they trace the concept of clothing. So there's lots to say about clothing. We gave one of the classes I gave before Purim was on the concept of clothing, why we get dressed up on Purim. The changing of clothing. There's a lot of clothing in the whole Purim story. A lot of people are constantly changing clothing. People who are not royalty are dressed up as royalty. People who are royalty are being taken away from their dressed up of royalty. Putting on sackcloth, taking off sackcloth. Mordechai gets dressed up. Esther gets dressed up. There's a lot of changing of the clothing. And so there's this element that we have about tracing the story. In any case, after all that, my point to you is, we have an entire verse that tells us that Rivka made the food and put Yaakov in his clothing, both of which are completely extraneous, because that's the whole, I mean, how did you make the food? Why did you know he gets dressed up? So it's significant for us to know she makes the food as Yaakov, as her husband Yitzchak, likes it, and she dresses Yaakov up in this garment, which are either on a literal level clean clothing, and the sages say on a deeper level the special clothing that Esav had taken from Nimrod and he was keeping with his mother. That's where it would be safest. Now Rashi continues. Well, what are they doing in her house? Esav was a married man. He was a successful married man. How many men at that stage are still keeping his clothing at his mommy's house? Says Rashi, but did Esav not have many wives? yet he gave them to his mother for safekeeping, because he knew well the conduct of his wives, and he was suspicious of them. So that this clothing, furthering the Torah's telling us, was of unique. In other words, how do we know that it was not just clean clothing? Because if it was just clean clothing, he would have kept it in his own house. There was something special about this clothing. That's why it was kept in his mother's house. Rivka was the one who watched it, because he knew that this clothing, which he had gotten from Nimrod, which had come all the way back from Adam and Eve, had his wives, his idolatrous wives, found out about what they were, you know, it would be on Craigslist before he knew it. So he kept it. He kept it in his mother's house. No, you don't think so?
Oh, that's too funny. Okay, verse 16.
And with the skins of the goat kids, she clothed his arms and his smooth skinned neck. So he's got two elements of clothing. He's got the element, the actual garment that he's wearing, our Esau's clothing, and then on his skin and on the back of his neck, she puts the goat hair, the skin that came off of the goat that she had just slaughtered, and clothed him with it. 17, Vatitena samatamim veshalacha vasher asosa beyad Yaakov bino. She placed the delicacies and the bread which she had made into the hand of her son Yaakov. Now, I don't have answers for these questions, but I have to point out all three of these verses we could have done without. All three of these verses are simply in a very drawn out, explicit, step-by-step level telling us that Yaakov went in. If we would have gone straight from verse 14, he brought his mother made delicacies the father loved, and came into his father with her. Would we have asked, well, what happened in between the time that he came into the house and the time he came to his father? We wouldn't have asked that question. We would have said, what do you mean? She just told him, get me some goats, I'm going to make them the way your father loves. So we're told in detail, she took them, she made the food, she put it in his hand, she baked some bread, which we've asked about, that the bread was never an element that had been specifically asked for, but on the most basic level we'll say is a staple of the meal, and therefore even though Yitzchak didn't request bread, apparently it was understood that bread should be part of it. We'll see whether or not Esav, it's referenced if he brings bread or not, but certainly when Rivka overhears the conversation and tells her son Yaakov to come in, she does send him with freshly baked bread as well, and we have him getting dressed up. Now, that seems to be important. That's part of the get up here, is that he's getting dressed up. Who's dressing him up?
Mother.
What role does Yaakov have in this entire episode so far?
Obedience.
Right, obedience. Exactly. In other words, she tells him, get me the goats, Torah says, as we start on the top of the page. So he went, he fetched, he brought them to his mother. He went and he got them. She then makes the delicacies. She then takes the clothing and she's clothing Yaakov. How old is Yaakov?
40. Is he in his
40s? He's more than that, because let's figure out, we know how old is Yitzchak?
46.
We learned last week how old Yitzchak was? Remember, he began to be afraid he was going to die because he had reached the age of within 5 years of his mother. His mother, Sarah, died at 127. He had reached the age of 122, 123, Rashi quoted. Remember how old he was when his twins were born?
47.
No? Seven? No? He was 60 when the twins were born. He got married at 40.
Oh, okay. That's
and then the 40. Twins were born 20 years later at 60.
Okay.
So if he's 123 at this stage, how old are Yaakov and Esav?
You want us to do the math in our heads?
Yeah, here's the problem. Okay, ready? 123 minus 60.
60.
Right? Or he's 63 years old.
Yeah.
He's a man who's 63 years old. And what does the Torah say? We just read it. She took the garments and clothed Yaakov, her younger son. So when you talk about obedience, the way the Torah is stressing this, it's as if he literally just stood there.
Like a child.
Right? And she says, this is what we're doing, listen to me. Get me the goats. Yes, ma'am. He goes in and gets the goats. She makes it. She clothes him, doesn't even say, she told him, in the closet your brother has some clothes, and go put those on. It doesn't even say it like that, which might have happened, but has the Torah tell it to us as if she clothed him. Vatalbesh es Yaakov. She clothed him. And then it says, who put the skins on? She puts the skins on his neck. Again, the language of Hilbisha al Yadav. She clothed him. And then, what does it say?
She placed
the delicacy of the bread into the hand of her son. Even the final verse, it doesn't even say, so he went and he took the tray. It's literally, he's just standing there, and she's putting on the clothing, she's putting on the skins, and she's putting the food into his hands and saying, go.
Should we really expect a 63-year-old man to be that passive?
Okay, so what I'm pointing out, and I think you know exactly is, as we go through this story, and one of the big questions we're going to have to deal with is, Yaakov is defined by numerous verses, and certainly in the language of the sages, as the Ish HaEmes, the man of truth. When you talk about each one of the Avos, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov had a trait that they were defined by. Avraham was Chesed, kindness. Avraham is the man of kindness who introduced that into the Jewish people through that. Yitzchak is Gevura, or strength. And Yaakov is Emes, which is a combination of kindness and strength. Those are two opposite approaches. Whether or not you deal with people with kindness or you deal with them with strength, they're very different approaches as to how forgiving, let's say, you'll be. Very, you know. And Yaakov is the synthesis of that in many ways, and he's Emeth. This story is a problem for the sages who define Yaakov as a man of truth. It's going to be a story from beginning to end. We're about to get into the meat and potatoes of that as far as his conversation now with his father.
Mm-hmm. But he lies.
We're gonna deal with that, right? You read the simple wording like, well, this isn't a story which exudes a man of truth. So I'm pointing out, as we go through the story, the Torah is stressing a fine nuance that you might have read this in shul 60 times, but until you stop and read it carefully, it's like, well, wait a minute. The verbs in these verses, which all are extreme, we don't need so many verses to describe. From the time that Rivka says, do as I say, all we needed was, he did. But we got a very, very explicit description of him going out, him bringing them. She prepares the meal. She clothes him. She puts the skins on. She puts the food in his hand. That last phrase, really, to me, she puts the... If I would have stopped that, how did the food get into Yaakov? What kind of question are you asking me? What do you mean? I don't care. He took it off the table. It doesn't matter. It's an irrelevant piece of information. How did the loaf of bread get to Yaakov's hands? Torah says it's not irrelevant. Not only is it not irrelevant, but you need to know how it got there. And I'll tell you how it got there. She put it in his hands. She made the food, she baked the bread, and then she put it in his hand. So that before walking in, we are given a clear description of, we will use that term of obedience, of Rivka having an idea, and Yaakov saying, yes, mom. I think this is a bad idea. I'm going to get curses. She says, we're going to do it. I'm taking the curses upon myself. And he says, yes, mom.
Reluctant participant.
But a participant in the sense of it's happening to him, he's being clothed, he's being adorned with goat skin, and he's allowing the food to be put, and we're going to see he's going to walk in.
He didn't do it himself.
He's going to take it from here, but it is clear, as the story is now going to introduce, we're going to shift right now as far as the scene would shift. But if you were scripting this, the Torah tells us what it should look like. If you were producing a play or a screen, a film of what this would look like, I don't know that many people would have envisioned it this way, of literally a Yaakov standing there as passive can be, having all of this done to him. know, you picture like the drama of him getting dressed in his room. That's not what happened. Now we're going to take it to the next step, in which once she pushes him in, now it's all up to him. Now he's been put in a place. In other words, we're going to say, but he lies. Well, let's keep the scene as the Torah has set it up for us. Whose idea was this? His mother's idea. Who puts him up to this? Who dresses him? Who prepares all... And now she pushes him in, and now we find the Isha Emes, the man of truth, on a mission in which his mother said, if you don't do this, your brother will receive the blessings. And if you remember the comments from the Ramban, and it will be before God. Who receives this bracha, whoever will receive this blessing, will be blessed forever, and then you will be out. And you, who I know, my son Yaakov, are the true bearer of this Abrahamic destiny, will be forever out to your brother Esav, who, as the Ramban also commented, Yaakov Yitzchak really wanted to give the bracha to. He was fooled. And so now here, the man of truth has been put into a position in which, well, now how do I manage this? I'm now in front of my father, and I'm on my own. I don't have my mother there to do it, because it's just me and Dad. And Dad thinks I'm Esav, and he wants to give me this bracha. And now we're going to see how he's going to balance. What the Torah is now going to do for us is balance that of, I need to be a man of truth, and I need to get this blessing. And we're going to see how the Torah is going to tell us how he manages. Okay, so far so good? Okay, here we go. 18. Vayavo el aviv vayomer avi. And he came to his father and he said, Father. Vayomer hineni, and his father said, Here I am, mi ata bini, who are you, my son? Now, we've said this before, let's go into this again. There's this theme which has gone over and over and over again, this hineni, here I am. And it's introduced, Yaakov's first words to, as he walks in, are, Avi. He starts with my father, which is exactly what, if you remember when Esau first came in, Yitzchak said to him, Bini, my son, and he said, Hineni, I'm here. And now Yaakov walks in and says, Avi, my father. And Yaakov responds, Yitzchak responds, Hineni, yes, here I am. Mi ata bini, who are you, my son? Now, Rashi and the Ramban are not going to comment on this. We ask the question, which I'm going to raise again, even though they're not going to comment. We ask the question, why does Yitzchak ask this question? Yitzchak just sent his son on a mission. What is he expecting? Okay, good. What was he expecting? He was expecting his son to come back with delicacies. When Yaakov walks in, he has to smell that he's got freshly baked bread and freshly cooked steak. So he's come in with the goods. And he says, Who are you, my son? So what we're going to see is, based on his words, which Yitzchak is going to say explicitly in a verse or two, how did he get here so fast? So that there's something on some level which is unusual in the story. And he asks it by saying, Who are you, my son? Now what's odd is that he says, Mi ata bini. So he knows it, he says, My son. Even if we go with the approach, which we've seen in the Ramban, that either they sounded exactly alike, or that Yaakov knew to make his voice sound like Esau's, it's clearly...
Couldn't tell from the voice.
But who are the options? Who in the world could possibly be here? It's only one or two people. It's either Esau, which he was expecting, or Yaakov. He says, Who are you, my son? Whoever is in front of him said, Abba, father, and he responds, Who are you, my son? Seems to be that through the voice and the fact that what has happened is exactly what he expected to happen, he knows it's either his son Esav, which he's expecting, or his younger son Yaakov, which would have to have been a very odd, big, like, how did you end up here in front of me with all of these delicacies? So he asks, Who are you, my son? Vayomer Yaakov el Aviv, Yud Tes 19. Yaakov then says to his father, Anochi Esav Bichorecha. It is I, Esav is your firstborn. Asisi Kaasher Dibarta Eloi. I have done as you told me. Kum na shiva, please sit up. The achla, oh, got cut off. I didn't realize. I'm sorry. The achla mitzed bini and eat. Let me read it. Make sure we get the whole verse straight. I'm sorry. I didn't realize that happened. The achla mitzedi, eat from my game. Ba'avor tivarchani nafshacha, in order that your soul may bless me. Verse 19. That's the full extent of what Yaakov responds. Okay, let's go through. How many overt problems do we have in this verse, 19?
Well, it's just the first time he's lied since he got the blessing.
Okay, let's point out, where are the so-called lies? Let's start with that.
Well, he deceived his father in the very beginning, by saying, it is I, Esau, your firstborn.
Okay, that's phrase number one. Anochi Esav Bichorecha. It literally would translate as, I am Esav, your firstborn. Mm-hmm. That's number one problem. Problem number two?
I've done as you told me.
Excellent. I've done as you told me, because what did Yitzchak told Esav to get the food? Who told Yaakov to get this food?
His mom.
That was his mother. But he's now saying to his father, I have done that which you have told me. So there are two elements of this statement that Yaakov responds. Now again, how many questions did Yitzchak ask him?
Who are you?
Right. He only asks him one question, which is, who are you, my son? And he responds with a lot more information than was specifically asked. What was asked, the answer to the question would have been Esav. He responds, Anochi Esav Bichorecha, it is I, Esav, your eldest son. And then he adds a speech. What does he add? I've done that which you have told me, which again we're going to have to deal with. That doesn't seem to be true. And then he adds, come, get up, please eat of the game so that your soul may bless me. Yeah, so far so good?
Well, nobody said anything about you, so...
Excellent. So now the question you're asking, which I think is a great question, which I, again, don't have an answer to yet. Yitzchak, said that phrase to Esav, that my soul shall bless you. But when Rivka said the story over to Yaakov, she left that phrase out. She said, your father told your brother to bring him food so that he may bless him before Hashem, before he dies. And now, Yaakov, when he says the story over to Yitzchak, says, in order that your soul shall bless me. How did he know that that's what Yitzchak had actually said? His only conduit to the story is his mother. And his mother didn't say that phrase. He just said that your father wants to bless him, not that his soul should bless him. Which is going to leave us with at least one possibility that I can think of. We'll see what else. Is that somehow, whatever that phrase means, Yaakov on his own intuited that it must be that way.
That's the way blessings are.
Right. That somehow, even though his mother didn't explicitly mention the idea of it's my soul that's going to bless you, she didn't say that. But then Yaakov on his own, when he comes to his father and says, I'm here to get the blessing, knew, intuited, that blessing it would fit to say it in the manner of, in order that your soul bless me. There might be another possibility. I'll have to see if we could find somebody who comments. But right now, focus on Rashi and Ramban. Neither of them make that comment, and they're not bothered by that. But I think it's of note that he goes back to that phrase, which is true, his father said it, but Yaakov wasn't there. He only knows about the story through his mother, and his mother did not say that phrase. Okay, let's deal with the two major problems. The two major problems are the two phrases which would seem to be untrue. The first phrase of, it is I, Esav of your firstborn. And the second phrase of, I have done that which you have asked of me. Rashi deals with both. Rashi deals with both. Let's see Rashi. Anokhi Esav v'charecha, verse 19 on your Rashi sheets. It is I, Esav, your firstborn, says Rashi. Anokhi ha-mevi l'cha, I am the one who is bringing this to you. Ve'esav hu v'charecha, and Esav is your firstborn. As if to say, Rashi says, that the words are not complete sentences. Anochi Esav v'chorecha is really two phrases. It's not to be read as, it is I, Esav, your firstborn, but it is I, comma. It is I, who am here, bringing you this stuff. And another fact or piece of information is, Esav happens to be your firstborn. But I'm not saying, I am Esav, your firstborn. I'm saying, I am the one bringing you this food. Esav is your firstborn as a statement of fact. This would be analogous to a lot of things. Let me just bring up what was it. This past Shabbos we had a speaker who was here, Rabbi David Katz of Baltimore, who's a historian. So he was saying that when you read history, so there are millions and billions of facts. If any period of history, looking at whatever, the 1920s. So you're going to be a historian, you're going to study the 1920s and come to some understanding of what took place. Well, how many facts are there to sift through in the 1920s? Right? Infinite number of facts. There are infinite number of, every day the newspaper was filled with stories, and you're going through a decade worth. The newspapers didn't fill in all the stories that happened. So as a historian, so you go through and you try to figure out which pieces of information are important ones and whole and piece together from that. And that's every historian's job, is to figure out what's really important to give you an accurate picture of what's taking place. It would be analogous to if you get the wrong pieces of information and you only take part of each story, you might come to a very different conclusion than if you actually had the whole piece. And as an analogy, he said, when you meet somebody and you say, oh, so nice to meet you, I hear you're looking for whatever, a job, for a shidduch, whatever, tell me a little bit about yourself and your family. So you do, in your 2 minutes presentation, you tell them a little bit about yourself and your family. Now, unless there's, as he said, something wrong with you, you're not going to tell him everything about yourself and your family. You just met him. You're going to tell him facts which paint a certain picture. Everything that you will say will be true, but have you told him the truth? No. Everything I said was true, but I didn't give you the truth, meaning I haven't really given you the accurate picture of what I and my family are like, even though all the words that I said were true.
I don't buy it in this context.
Well, 1 second. So that there's a concept in which the words that you're saying can be true, but they're just not giving an accurate picture.
To the conversation. It is I.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing wrong with that. He hasn't messed anything up.
Right.
And then he defines who it should be.
Right, that Esav is your firstborn.
Right. And I'm not going any further.
But the inference.
Correct. So what's going on over here, the sages are saying, Yaakov is caught.
Answer.
Yaakov is caught between a rock and a hard place. His mother has commanded him to go in there, to dress up like Esav, which she does personally herself, cooks all the food, bakes all the bread, and says, you must get this bracha. Okay, I could do that, Mom. Problem is, Dad says, who are you, my son? And I'm now caught between... how in the world do I manage the situation? So Yaakov teaches us how he manages the situation. Saying something which has a clear inference that what he means to say is, I am Esav. He in every way intends on deceiving his father and on making his father think that he is Esav. There is no question about that. That is his goal. That is his intention. And he uses words which not only could be interpreted that way, but that he intends to be interpreted that way. And, at the same time, in the way that he says it in a way that it also could be interpreted not as an outright lie, so that the words that he said aren't a lie. Anochi, Esav v'choracha. It is I have brought you this stuff. And Esav is your firstborn. Is that what he meant for his father to understand from his words? No. He wanted his father to understand that he was Esav. That's what has to happen. And the way that he does it, now that I'm caught, I have to fulfill both of these things of being as truthful as I can while being as deceptive as I can. So he says it in words that he intended to be interpreted in a way that his father interpreted that. That's what he wanted. I want my father to think I'm Esav, yet that the actual words which come out of his mouth are not an outright lie. They can be interpreted in a way that they are truthful.
But it's the first time that he is active.
Yes, this is now the first time in which he has to figure this out. Meaning everything until this point in this story is his mother is taking the initiative and telling him what to do. And now he is thrust into the story, and his father said, again, if we were screening a play, and we can freeze frame it after his father says to him, "Who are you, my son?" And we can now, work through the inner workings of the mind of Yaakov. How in the world should I answer this? Now what am I supposed to do? So what he comes up with is a phrase that at the same time was clearly intended to give his father the impression that he indeed is Esav. And he chose his words in a way that can also be interpreted in a way that's not an outright lie. So that a balance between I need to be deceptive, I need my father to think something other than I am who I am, and I'm using the words that allow the most truth to be read into them while I'm engaged in deception. Yeah.
But he continues the deception by saying, "I have done as you told me."
Correct. Let's read the next phrase in Rashi. And then we'll get back to that. See, very next phrase in Rashi, see where I am? I have done many things as you told me. I have done many things as you told me. Is this statement true? In other words, if you put in a vacuum, if Yaakov were to say to his father, "I have done as you have told me," true or false?
It's in the past tense.
It's very, right. I have done as you have told me. So again, you see the exact same idea in which Yaakov is saying, "What am I doing? This is what you wanted. Come eat, please." So he says it. "I have done." He doesn't say, "I hunted the game as you have told me," because he didn't. So instead of saying, "Here, Dad, I have hunted the game and prepared it as you have asked me to," that would not be true. So he says, "I have done what you have told me." A much more general, broad phrase, which, while again intending to be deceptive, he needs his father to think he's Esav. So while he's intending to be deceptive, he chooses his words in a way that allows for the most truth to be contained within the words. So instead of saying, "I have hunted as you have told me," which would be an outright lie, because his father indeed never in his life probably told him to hunt, and he doesn't say, "I've prepared as you've told me to," because he might never have had that experience either. He says, "I have done that which you have told me," which is true. "I have done many things like you have told me." Not particularly related to the food I'm holding in my hands, but I didn't say that. I just said, "It is I, Esav is your firstborn," balancing that act. "I have done what you have told me." That statement in a vacuum is true. "Please come eat from the meal that's here."
But that all seems wrong.
So in other words, we're not yet addressing the big elephant in the question, which is, how can it be that this is the way that Yaakov receives the blessings from his father? That's the big elephant question, in the sense of, that when someone's sitting next to you on the plane and says, "I don't understand the Jews, you're telling me that the blessing from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob went from Isaac down to Jacob, and the whole thing was a scam? I don't understand. That doesn't make any sense to me." We have to answer that question when we get done with that. That's a good question. That's a good question. What we're addressing now is, as he's doing it, Not in the big scheme of why would God set up a scenario, or how is it that we are to make sense of this scenario, that the big blessing gets transferred right away. We're talking second generation, Avram to Yitzchak, and then from Yitzchak down to Yaakov happens in such a manner. Good question, big question, we don't have an answer to that yet. But within the details of the story, how did Yaakov do this? So in that, what Rashi's pointing out to us is every step of the way either was done by his mother, the prophetess who told him this needs to be done to him, and then when he becomes the active initiator, it's done with words chosen in a way that allow for the most truth within deception. It's a balancing act. That's what's going on. It is clearly meant to be deceptive, and it's done in a way that there's no outright that the words that I'm saying are false. If he would have said, I prepared the game as you told me, that's an outright lie. So it's not true. So I say my words in a way that give that connotation. I intend for you to interpret my words that way, but that's not. I didn't. You can't say that in a vacuum. That's what the words mean. This again, there's a tremendous lesson in all of this, that almost all of our words in our regular everyday conversations are interpreted within context.
And there's an intent here.
Right.
I mean, you just hit on it. There was an intent.
100%. That's what the Torah is telling us. Within the intent to deceive was the quest for the most truth possible within the intent to deceive.
Something he could live with.
Right. In other words, we're literally balancing that. You know, I started with, how does a man of truth go through such an episode? Well, watch. The Torah is going to tell us that his mother was involved and the driving force behind the idea. And then the man of truth put in a deceitful situation does it in the way that allows the most truth to shine through in a intentionally deceitful situation. That's the balancing act.
This is bothering me the whole time because I can't remember. When Jacob said, give me your blessing and I'll give you the porridge, was it not Jacob who said it?
He did, yeah, sure.
So he actually created this whole thing.
Okay, there's another question that we've asked in the sense of, what did it mean when he bought the birthright? Should he have anyway been entitled to these blessings? Or was the birthright something separate? The birthright is double portion or something or another, but not necessarily these blessings. If we learn that, you know, if we're going to remember from Esau's response when he eventually walks in and he says, he stole two things from me. First he stole my birthright, and now he cheated me out of my blessings. Sounds like from Esau's response, two separate things, and the fact that he sold his birthright did not entitle Yaakov to these blessings. That's what we'll have to deal with that. So that's a separate thing, versus if we say, no, he was entitled to them. Why he needed to take them in this way is a good question, but he was entitled to them. From Esau, it's going to sound like he was not entitled to them. And again, we raise the same question of, well, why didn't Yaakov go in there, or Rivka go in there and say, hey, Yitzchak, you're making a mistake. Yaakov bought the birthright. Now, the Ramban a little bit addressed that, as we've seen, because the Ramban said, because Rivka knew that she needed the blessings to be given with a full heart. And that if Yitzchak would suddenly, in the last minute, be told that he's giving it to the wrong person, he would somehow not really give it over as the way that it needed to be done. But
do you think Jacob didn't know? I mean, that Isaac didn't know that it was Jacob in his presence? Do you think
he missed the earlier?
Yeah, no, that's clear. The whole story. Yeah. He says, yeah, 100%. He thinks this is his son Esau.
They're twins.
Yeah.
The
voices with 100%.
No, I don't think so. I think the voices, I think the reason, well, it could be the reason that he asked, you know, who are you, is because there was a different inflection in the voice that made him wonder, you know, which son he was.
It could be. We saw in the Ramban had a couple of approaches, whether or not they had the same voice or Yaakov had to pretend. But either way, the story is clear that Yitzchak has no idea that it's Yaakov. As we're going to read through the story, it's clear that he has no idea. He might have some suspicion, which is why he's asking all these questions. Who are you? It's the voice of Yaakov. There's clear that he might be suspicious because of the questions that he's going to ask, that when he gives the blessings, he believes fully that the person to whom he's giving the blessings is his son, Esav, from his shock when Esav later walks in. That's clear. He's going to be shocked when Esav walks in.
Okay.
All right, we'll pick up Mirat Hashem after Pesach.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.